Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here. I'm in the home studio here at Pond City Market, but my interview guest, Mr. Chris Weitz, was in New York City. Don't do a lot of these remote hookups much. I've talked about it before. It's not the greatest situation in the world, but Chris was a really good guy and very conversational, and I think we pulled it off. You might know Chris from, he's done so many things. He started his career and got the most attention right out of the gate with a movie he co-directed with his brother, American Pie, and just got so much collateral on that first film being such a big hit. He was able to do a lot of interesting things after that, like acting in a wonderful sort of demented little indie that I love called Chuck and Buck. He also co-directed Down to Earth, was nominated for an Oscar Award for screenplay for About a Boy, which he co-wrote and co-directed as well. Just a wonderful, wonderful film. One of my favorites. He also was a writer on Rogue One, a Star Wars movie. And his new film in theaters August 29th is called Operation Finale. And they set up a screening for me here in Atlanta. And boy, was it good. It's a story of the real true story of the hunt and capture and trial of Adolf Eichmann. He was one of the one of the architects of the Nazi campaign in World War II, and kind of the only one of the big three that escaped justice for a long time, living in South America under a different name. They finally caught up to him, and this is that story, starring Ben Kingsley as Eichmann and Oscar Isaac as kind of the guy who leads the team in a sort of Argo-esque way to grab and kidnap this man and get him out of the country somehow under the radar. And also co-stars Nick Kroll and Melanie Laurin. And she's just wonderful in everything that she's in. It was just a really good movie, a very taut, suspenseful, sort of ticking clock political thriller, period piece. It's all those things. Really good movie. Hope you guys go out and see it. You'll really enjoy it. And we had a great talk today about his career and his interesting life growing up. I did not know that he had a long family history in Hollywood and beyond, so that was super cool to learn about. And his pick was just a little film, just a little nothing indie called Lawrence of Arabia, one of the, probably the epic of all epics in the age of the epic Hollywood film. Lawrence of Arabia even stands alone. And I had never seen it. And this is one of those. It's long been on the list, and I got to watch it at my house. I'm definitely going to go check it out in the theater next time they have a an anniversary screening or something, because it was something else. What a great, great film. I get the hype now, everyone. Lawrence of Arabia is awesome and really something to behold as a viewer. So we had a great conversation, even though we were 1,000 miles apart. Here we go with Chris Weitz on Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah, I'm glad we're getting to talk because you are a you're a multi-hyphenate, as they call it in the business.
Yeah. Well, let me see. So I mean, the actor stuff doesn't really count because I only did that twice.
Oh, but Chuck and Buck is such a good movie.
Chuck and Buck sticks in people's minds.
I loved it.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
I'm a huge Mike White fan, and it was
he's brilliant.
Yeah, that's a great one.
That was. I'm so glad I did that movie before I got too established to worry, not to worry about it. It was great. really bizarre the way that came about, which is that Miguel Arteta, who had gone to school with my brother, and sent us both the script because we looked alike, basically. Because he needed two characters to look like, and he wanted to have non-actors in it. There were no other qualifications, really.
I loved it, man. I thought it was great. And it was, it's interesting because you're a guy who, and this is one of my favorite qualities, I think, in a filmmaker is you've really done a lot of different things in your career. I mean, obviously you and your brother, I mean, you co-wrote the movie Ants, an animated film. And then you and your brother really made your name for yourself with the American Pie movie. And then right after that, you starred in Chuck and Buck and then did Down to Earth and About a Boy. And like you really, I never knew what to expect from you guys, and I always appreciate that about artists.
We try to keep things weird in general, have the strangest filmographies possible. I mean, I think when we got the chance to direct our first movie, it happened to be American Pie, and it's a movie that I love and loved making, but it wasn't like the thing that my heart desired most of all. I'd never been to high school in America. Didn't go to prom, so I was working in a genre that I didn't really know very well.
Uh-huh.
So definitely the intent was to do something different as soon as possible. And Chuck and Buck was the next thing that we did. It was a sort of strange indie possibility, you know, feature shot on DV. As close to a dogma film, I think, as you can get in America at the time. And also some weird kind of sexual politics stuff, LGBTQ before all of the letters had been put together in that way, kind of interesting intersectional stuff that was great to be a part of, because also I sort of felt like, I felt a little guilty having made a studio film. Now I don't feel guilty anymore, but it was a way to sort of say, oh, you know, we have this kind of foot in the indie world. My brother still makes independent films, which is great, and I will probably do that next. I think that the thing was not to be pigeonholed. I mean, there's a threat to that too, though, which is that you sort of don't get a brand, and everybody apparently has to brand themselves. But it's because you don't necessarily have an identifiable visual gallery of things. They're quite different in a way. But I'm happy to live with that.
Yeah, I mean, American Pie certainly got you guys a ton of collateral, like to have a smash hit like that right out of the gate. And I think, I mean, I don't know how it works on the inside. You talked about having a brand, but it seems like you get a lot of interesting things thrown your way, whether it be like the Twilight franchise with New Moon, or for God's sakes, writing Rogue One.
Yeah.
I mean, what an opportunity, you know?
That was a huge opportunity. That was a dream for me. I mean, I saw Star Wars when I was 7, and my favorite film would be Star Wars, except that I think it's too boring because it's everybody's favorite film. when I got to write Rogue One, it was something that I've been hoping for years since I'd heard that they were going to make new films, and it happened to be exactly what I would have wanted to do, which was the opening crawl. That is to say, you know, I'm kind of an ultra-orthodox Star Wars fan. Like, all that really matters to me are episodes 4, 5, and 6. And nothing outside of that is canon to me. So to be able to work in that area was just fantastic.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I rarely do this, but I put out a call on our Facebook page about, you know, I'm talking to Chris Weitz, what do you want me to talk about? And I think about 80% of the people talked about Rogue One, and the fact that I think among Star Wars fans, it's, I think, widely considered the best of the new lot.
Oh, that's super cool. I'm glad. I think that's thanks to Gareth Edwards, really, and the what he wanted to do, the stamp that he put on it. I think that the things, I mean, there a lot of terrific writers worked on that, and it's amazing that it sort of holds together, given how many people did. But I think the reason is his work. You know, he was a fan as well. I mean, in some ways, Rogue One is kind of a fan movie.
Yeah.
It's just a fan movie if you were given all of the tools at your disposal. And I think, I mean, I like the other films very much. Obviously, I can't judge without bias. But, you know, Solo, when you look at that, is a movie made by some of the original makers of these films. Mm-hmm. So, but this is, Rogue One was, the people who grew up on it and who had desperately wanted to do it and do it correctly when they had the chance. So I think there's a lot of deep love of especially episode 4 in it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So when you're like for someone who can who writes and produces and directs, what goes into your decision making process career wise, like when to tackle what?
Right. Well, I think with directing, it comes down, it has to be something that I really desperately feel I have to do or I'll regret it deeply.
Right, investment.
I'm not a gigging director. I'm not thinking about what to do next, and I don't make a film a year or even a film every 2 years. And in part, that's because I can't necessarily stand the physical and mental pressure of doing it,
yeah.
or whatever, at least what I put on myself. And, you know, it is a lot of work. And I have a family. I have three children, and sort of it takes me away from them every time I do that. So I sort of have to justify being a bad parent for a while. So that's the highest bar to reach. In terms of writing, I mean, I get kind of excited about when I feel like I know how to fix something occasionally, which is sort of rewriting work. And also I love adapting the work of novelists and sort of trying to convey what's great about those books in another medium. In a way that I would hope that the novelists themselves can approve of. There's that. So that's kind of my connection to what I studied in college, which was English. What else? Acting. I will pretty much do anything anyone asks me, but nobody does.
What else? Nice.
And producing is kind of, if I can help somebody do one of those things, which is to say, like, work on something they really, really care about, then that's great. You know, I've been really fortunate in getting Kogo Nada's first movie made, Columbus, which was a beautiful film starring John Cho and Haley Lou Richardson. We are producing Lulu Wang, her second movie, which is based on a This American Life episode about her family, which she did. And so it's really cool to be able to intervene beneficially early in someone's career. And also that's true of this science fiction film Prospect, starring Pedro Pascal that went to South by Southwest this year. That's sort of the best part of producing, I think. Yes, that is the long answer to your short question.
Well, I mean, speaking of working on books, you know, About a Boy was such a great book, and you guys, you and your brother did such a wonderful job. It's a beloved movie. And you got an Oscar nomination for screenplay for that.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I know. That's great. What was it like working with Nick? How involved was he?
Well, Nick, I think at the time, you know, now he can adapt his own stuff. He can adapt other people's stuff. He can write stuff from scratch, and he's doing just fine on his own, which he probably intended to do all along. So I think he found it probably a bit of a too painful a prospect to stay too close to events when we were shooting it. So we had some really good meetings with Nick early and liked each other a lot, but I think he decided to step away so as not to see how we were going to mangle what he had done.
Oh, no.
You know, fortunately, he approved of it after the fact. I think he's been, you know, really kind about the movie. I think he was sort of surprised at people not noticing how much we changed the final kind of act of the novel, let alone you know, changing the time period. But it's really gratifying that he likes what we made of it. That said, I suspect that that if he had done this later in his career, he would have adapted his own work and done it really beautifully.
Right.
So the chance to adapt that and thus to get the only shred of prestige
that's not true
was fantastic. It just felt I felt very much like I was born to write that script, or rather sort of educated to write that script, because I kind of like lived amongst the English for long enough, having gone to high school and college there, that I understood what was going on, and felt like capable of translating that into an American mode in some ways. But in some ways, it was an English picture.
Yeah.
And it was like this fantastic moment in a test screening in London when someone said, oh, it's a good English film.
Nice.
That was a really charmed production, the whole thing. I remember just everything that we decided to do kind of working out the way that we had wanted it to, which is fantastic and doesn't really happen. Like, I remember at one point thinking, oh, it'd be great if, you know, Badly Drawn Boy could write an original album for this movie.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. And we called him up and he's like, yeah, okay.
That's awesome.
Everything in that sense kind of worked out, from Hugh Grant doing it to sort of taking a flyer on Nick Holt, even down to Toni Collette doing it was an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, she's so great. Is it mm-hmm. weird to do you see Nick Holt today and like marvel at what a big grown handsome grown man he's become?
He is a complete hunk.
Yeah.
And he's a really good actor too. And you don't necessarily know if somebody who can play a 12-year-old really well at 12 is going to be able to play grown-ups. Yeah, I mean, we stay in touch, and I just love sort of watching him grow. it's really funny.
Yeah, that's awesome. Where are you from? You said you went to high school in England?
Yeah, well, I'm from New York originally, but my dad had gone to school in England. He went to grade school, the equivalent of grade school and high school in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was supposed to just go for a year to check out my dad's old school in London when I was 14. And I ended up staying and doing my exams there, A-levels, they're called, mm-hmm. kind of the end of high school exams. And then got into Cambridge and I stayed. And I stayed for a few years. And I've ended up working on a few movies there, which is great. So I'm New Yorker, but sort of mid-Atlantic in education.
Right. What is your mother from England as well, or?
No, my mom is from, she was born in L.A., mm-hmm. but her mother was Mexican. Her mom was actually a Mexican silent film actress. And
oh, wow.
Her dad, my grandfather, was from the Czech Republic, which at that time was Austria, and then became Czechoslovakia, mm-hmm. and then became the Czech Republic,
right.
through various world wars, hot and cold. So I'm kind of from all over. I mean, like a lot of Americans are.
Now, with you and your brother, was filmmaking something you always wanted to get into? Or, I mean, is it in your family lineage at all?
It was. So my mom was an actor. She's actually in a film which is in my film. So she was in a film called Imitation of Life in 1959. She played an African American woman passing as white in this great Douglas Sirk film from 1959.
Wow.
Her father was a producer and agent, and he was an agent for a lot of European filmmakers. He was Ingmar Bergman's agent. He was Billy Wilder's agent.
Holy cow.
So there's that sort of, that part of the family goes back in terms of filmmaking. And my grandma was known as La Novia de Mexico, which means the sweetheart of Mexico. She was kind of the first talking picture star in Mexico. And before that, she'd been a silent film actress in Hollywood. So
wow.
That's kind of a cool story too. Yeah. So this is like the family business.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really cool.
Mm.
So were you and your, I mean, so obviously you guys, I mean, I usually ask people about their influences growing up. And certainly when you have an older sibling, I have an older brother and an older sister, you get a lot of culture fed through them.
Absolutely.
Was that sort of your jam as kids growing up?
That was definitely, you know, all the good music, and stuff came through my brother, and eventually he started writing plays, which he still does. When I graduated from college, we thought it would be kind of a wheeze to write screenplays together. We didn't really have a clear idea of what was going to come of it. It just mm-hmm. seemed like it might be a cool thing, and maybe it would work out. And it did. We worked hard, but we were also very lucky. I remember on my 21st birthday, we had pitched a story to MGM, and they said, yeah, you know, we'll pay you to write a screenplay. It was a long time between that and getting screen credit, which was on Ants,
mm-hmm.
Which I think came out in 1998,
97. Yeah, that sounds about right.
So that was like 7 years to that point of just working on our own stuff and rewriting other people's stuff, but never really getting anything made. And then it sort of all started with that for us.
Did you ever have to yell, my grandfather was Billy Wilder's agent, for God's sake?
I feel the funny thing is, although we did have this sort of background in film, it was like an old film and European film, like from a totally different era. So like by the time the 90s rolled around, nobody really cared. But now it's nice to look back on.
Yeah, that's awesome. I got to see Operation Finale 2 days ago.
Cool. Thank you for watching it.
Great.
Excellent.
It was really good, man. I mean, again, with kind of not having like a direct through line through your career, you've done all these interesting films, things like Ants and American Pie, About a Boy, mm-hmm. and then you do what feels like a heist movie, even though it's not exactly, but it sort of has the DNA of a heist movie as a sort of a ticking clock thriller, which is, you know, it's one of my favorite genres. And I know that's something in screenwriting where they say, hey, if you can get a ticking clock going, you had the luxury of having a real ticking clock built into the real life story.
Yep.
Which was, it really gave it a lot of intensity.
Thank you. I'm glad it did. In some ways it's got sort of all these genre, bells and whistles. It's a kidnapping plot, mm-hmm. you know, the true story. Mossad, kidnapped, Adolf Eichmann, who was, the kind of logistics coordinator, of the Holocaust. They found out he was in Buenos Aires and put together a team to extract him and take him to Israel for trial. Pretty extraordinary cinematic story from the get-go.
Oh yeah.
I wanted it to be a kind of a hybrid of a genre suspense thriller and also at the same time kind of reckoning with who this person Adolf Eichmann was and what it was like for the for a team of people whose families had been destroyed in the Holocaust to have to live with him for the 10 days in which they wait in a safe house to be taken out by LL.
Yeah, man. It was just so intense because, you know, it felt like about half the people just wanted to torture and kill him.
Yeah.
But you also, as a filmmaker, and I think to your credit, you know, you needed to tell the story also of this old man whose response is, am I to blame for all of World War II?
Right.
You know, so it was really interesting to kind of, and of course, he is a bad guy, and there are some
really very bad guy.
Tough, affecting scenes in the film. But I think to your credit, to even indulge that line of thought from him was pretty necessary.
I think so. I mean, I think it's important to see the people who perpetrate these crimes as human beings, not because we should feel sympathy for them, mm-hmm. but because we should be alive to the possibility of it happening in our time, in our country, in our culture, in ourselves as well. So I think the temptation is always there to make them as evil as possible on the surface. But we aimed to sort of try to seduce the characters and in a way the audience into viewing them as people as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, you've had this long, successful career, worked with all kinds of people, but I imagine even at this stage, to be directing those scenes with Ben Kingsley and Oscar Isaac, just the two of them, like, that had to be pretty cool.
It is extremely cool. I mean, on the one level, you can just sort of let them fly and know that you're going to get great stuff. Another level, sort of to try to keep up with them and what they're doing is a huge challenge. And, you know, even with a studio film, time is always running out in terms of the number of takes you're going to get to sort of solidify what the character is going to be. Mm-hmm. So it is, it's exciting. It's really daunting. You know, any actor who's been working as long as I have been working as a director has actually been in three or four times as many movies as I have directed. So that, is interesting as well. They bring a tremendous amount of experience of different, performances, to the table. But it was actually, when all was said and done, surprisingly smooth, the whole process. There wasn't a lot of hammering things out.
Yeah. Well, when, there were some scenes with Ben Kingsley as the young Eichmann.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do that? Was that all makeup or was there some CG involved?
There was some CG. There was some CG involved. We're getting pretty good at doing that.
Yeah, it really looked believable, I thought. And you didn't, I think the key to that stuff is not overdoing it and hanging yep. too long, not to mention another Star Wars movie. I won't go there.
Right.
But you sort of played it just right, I think, and it came off as super believable.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad. You know, it's really sort of tricky to try to get that stuff right, to sort of de-age a person to mm-hmm. the appropriate level that is right for the scenario, not to have it go into uncanny valley.
Yeah.
To maintain the sort of performance qualities. It was a company called Shade VFX in Los Angeles, and I worked very hard, Los Angeles and New York, and we all worked very hard together to try to get that right.
How did the story come to you?
I was sent the script by MGM 2 years ago. John Glickman, who's the head of things over there, knew that I had had some experience with the period because of my dad. My dad wrote biographies of prominent Nazi Party members.
Oh, wow.
And I sort of helped him put together his library and did some of, helped him with his research and copyright his manuscripts. So I was kind of immersed in this stuff mm-hmm. As a child. And so in spite of the fact that my first movie was a teen sex comedy,
right.
this was like not totally alien to me.
Yeah.
So I hadn't had a chance to do something in this period. It was very exciting.
Yeah. I mean, it was just beautifully shot. It was a very, very good looking movie.
Thank you. That's, Javier Aguirre-Cerobe, a wonderful Spanish DP who also shot The Others and The Road, which is a very beautiful movie,
oh,
shot
yeah.
Blue Jasmine. He has a beautiful sort of burnished, yet still realistic style. And he and I have now worked together on three movies, kind of know each other's ways. And I think that a great thing about Javier's work is that he doesn't have anything to prove. We're not kind of pushing camera moves and, mm-hmm. You know, gyrating around or taking on sort of artistic angles just for the sake of it.
Yeah, it was not flashy. It just came across as a very, just a good looking movie.
Oh, thanks.
That's the best way to say it, I think. And then Nick Kroll is in it, which big fan of his comedy. And it's, I mean, there are a couple of lighter moments with him, but mm-hmm. he definitely played against type here, and it was good to see.
That's a serious role. And he's actually a very serious, thoughtful guy, as I think a lot of good comedians are. There's always a sort of a darkness to comedy. I think Nick brought a real thoughtfulness to the part. He had actually, when he was a kid, known one of the members of the expedition who was an associate of his father's. Mm-hmm. Nick's father works in corporate security. So he also sort of felt connected to the part.
Yeah, was it important for you to try and cast Jewish actors as much as you could for those roles?
I felt like that wasn't a requirement. There are some non-Jewish actors playing Israelis. I felt like there's probably an elusive balancing point at which you are, goy washing things, as it were.
Right.
And there's also a point at which you're being a little too restrictive by saying that only Jewish actors can play Jewish parts.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of wonderful Israeli actors in the film, Leo Raz and Ohad Noller. The mission itself, on the mission itself, some of the agents were born in Israel, but the rest of them were born in Germany and Poland and Romania and Hungary. And so it was kind of an international group anyway.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I can't wait for, I'll give it a good plug with the listeners before and after in the intro piece, but
Thank you.
Can't wait to see this thing in the theater.
Awesome.
I think you're going to do quite well, sir, with it.
I hope so. Yeah, we worked hard. I hope so.
So we can move into Lawrence of Arabia now.
Let's move.
Which is, I have to admit, I had never seen this movie.
Oh, man. And like, if you had to see it because I said so, did you know you were in for an over 3 hour long movie?
I did. I mean, this is one of those that I've always wanted to see. I knew it wasn't like, well, what is this? I've never heard of this.
Right.
It's been on the long list, and I've admitted there are so many classics like this I need to get around to. So I owe you some gratitude for quote unquote forcing me to watch this.
It's a great film.
Oh man, just unbelievable. 1962, David Lean directed, and then you know, of course, Peter O'Toole. Was that his very first movie?
I believe it was his very first movie.
That's crazy.
I think it was introducing Peter O'Toole. He may have been in a bit part in something or other, but it's the one that really broke him.
Yeah.
You didn't. I don't suppose you were able to see it on a big screen. That was it, every once in a while.
I knew you were going to ask that.
It'll get shown. Because no, not because, not to sort of say like you can't speak properly to it, but it's an amazing experience to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, it played here. I believe the 70mm print played in Atlanta a few years ago. Didn't get to see it, but now that is like on my list to, because I know they still show the restored version.
Yep.
From time to time. And I have a great big TV, but I definitely want to see this on the big screen.
It's
all about the big screen.
It was definitely shot very wide, very big. I think it was Jack Cardiff, wasn't it? Was it or was it Freddie Young?
It's Freddie Young.
Freddie Young. Yeah. Okay. Nicholas Rogue shot Second Unit. Interesting thing about
I saw that.
About that. That's pretty wild. Yes. Okay. So here is, I suppose, what's problematic about my saying this is my favorite movie. There are no women in this movie.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's hard to hang on to it as a favorite movie in these times. But I'm going to make an argument that in some ways there is a kind of, well, as Noel Coward said about Peter O'Toole, if he were any prettier, they'd call it Florence of Arabia. That there are some sort of gender fluid dynamics in the movie. But I fully cop to the fact that it's kind of lame to like a movie that has zero women in it. However, I do think that the screenplay and cinematography and performances are absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, but to be fair, like, would this movie have been any better if they forced in some kind of lame love relationship?
Yeah, probably not. And probably the fact of the matter, it in a way, it is about horrible things that men do. And so I don't by any means think that this is entirely a heroic story. As a matter of fact, I think it's got a running critique of the heroic male ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm not sure that would make it a better film as the film that it is.
Yeah. And for the time, I mean, I went and did some research afterward cause I didn't know much about T.E. Lawrence or his story.
Mm-hmm.
Widely speculated and generally agreed upon that he was probably gay.
Yes.
And the way they treated in the movie for 1962, I thought was pretty brave in that they just kind of let the movie be, didn't make anything over the top, but didn't cast any judgments or make any big statements about it either.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that his character, Omar Sharif's character, Anthony Quinn's character, it's a bit of a love triangle, as well as the young kind of Arab young men who are serving Lawrence. There's clearly something there. In as much as the film was able to address those things, I think it did sort of entertain the fact that these were men who were in love with one another while they were doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it shames them for it either. I think it's very clear that there are these kind of very intimate bonds between these guys. that weren't seen as beyond the pale or something shameful either. You know, there's this really funny turn in the dialogue when Anthony Quinn says to Omar Sharif that, you know, Lawrence has lied about something.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he is not perfect. And it's clear that for that entire time, they've both been kind of maintaining this notion that that Peter O'Toole, who is perfect enough looking and seeming, is some kind of ideal. And that ideal is kind of broken down over the course of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting character piece with, especially having never seen it and heard so much about it, I knew it was this epic of epics and that the photography was amazing. In 70 millimeter, these super beautiful wide shots. But I had never heard much about the story. And like I said, did know about T.E. Lawrence. And it's just such an interesting character piece that this guy, this, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, gorgeous Englishman,
mm-hmm.
goes by himself to the middle of nowhere because he has an affinity for the Arab people and
yep.
kind of becomes almost godlike to them.
Yeah. And falls from grace and is eventually kind of discarded at the end of it too. I mean, there are all
yeah.
kinds of interesting, to me, interesting critiques of colonialism, of heroism, of the West, going on in this movie that, if you just sort of went on what people say about it, really seems like kind of a gung-ho, war story, a heroic mm-hmm. great man war story. And it, you know, there are these extraordinary scenes like the attack on the Turkish armored train, attack on Aqaba, mm-hmm. all of these amazing war scenes, which are genuinely rousing. And there's kind of a survival adventure going on. But at the same time, underneath the surface, there's this real sense that T.E. Lawrence was a deeply troubled, tortured figure
mm-hmm.
Who could not live with his Englishness, could not become an Arab, which is perhaps what he most wanted to become, was lost in the world, was deeply vain, kind of strangely masochistic, and ends up both becoming a hero and being totally undone by his experiences.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long movie, but it never feels long. It doesn't feel like, I mean, he hangs on certain scenes, but it always seems, David Lean does, but it always seems like for the right amount of time, and it should be a close to 4-hour movie.
Yeah, I think that's right. I know maybe these days it would be a miniseries or something, but to me, like if you know what you're getting in for, it's a pretty amazing ride. So I had the chance to work with Ann Coates, the editor of Lawrence of Arabia. She edited The Golden Compass.
Oh wow!
For me, she recently passed away. Rest in peace. A very very dear, incredibly talented woman who, you know, maybe made the greatest cut in all of cinema history.
With The Match?
The Match, yes, The Match cutting to the Rising Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Who had an incredible sense of pacing, and not pacing in terms of speeding things up, but in terms of the right way into and out of scenes, you know, who sort of popularized flat cuts as opposed to transitions.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, like amongst the many things that are working at absolute highest gear, is the editing of the film. I think there's just so many aspects in which this film absolutely shines that this was like kind of the obvious choice for me.
Yeah, I mean, the cinematography gets so much attention here. I'm glad that you shouted out the editing and the writing. Just the, I mean, you talk about character complexity. You have a character in Lawrence that wants almost to be worshipped by the Arab world, is almost like a traitor to England in certain ways,
mm-hmm.
as far as where his heart is. And willing to execute a guy, but also having a weird aversion to guns and violence in some ways.
Right. Yeah, it has a very strange, it has a very interesting take on violence and the appeal of violence and brutality, the impulse towards it. There's a very strange moment in the film in which Lawrence, he and his kind of band of marauders have derailed a train, and they're killing the Turkish, not just Turkish soldiers, but Turkish citizens on board this train crossing the desert. And Lawrence looks down and sees a wounded Turkish officer, and the Turkish officer fires at him and kind of wings Lawrence. And and Lawrence is, he says, good, good, good. It's a very strange line reading. Too, he's happy to have been shot but not killed, because and the movie doesn't set this up terribly carefully, but it's that is to say, it doesn't set up in an obvious way, he is pleased to have been injured, I think in part because he now feels like a fully fledged male, which of course is sick, and I think also very carefully the I think David Lean casts the Turkish officer very carefully as well, because he's a very beautiful man. There's something very strange and homoerotic going on in that wounding there. There's a kind of a, you know, it's like a rite of passage or a loss of virginity in a way, which also frankly happens. Lawrence is raped later. You don't really, it's not really, incredibly obvious, that's that to me. It's that's clearly what happens when he is later captured by the Turks.
Right.
So there are all kinds of really extraordinary, intense, and deep things going on in this movie that really set it apart from, say, Bridge on the River Kwai, which is, you know, David Lean's. I think that was his later. I think that came later.
That was actually anyway, right before he.
Right before. Okay.
He did Bridge on the River Kwai, this, and Dr. Zhivago, all three in a row, which is pretty astounding.
What a run! But Bridge on the River Kwai, I think, is a lot more straightforward in terms of how it deals with kind of men and heroism.
Yeah, I mean, during the scene you were talking about, where he's has the little flesh wound on his arm, he almost wants to be shot again. I feel like, because he doesn't hide; he kind of stands there.
Right.
While this guy keeps pointing and shooting at him and missing. And yeah. I was just like, what are you doing, man? Get out of there. But there was this weird, that was definitely a strange scene to kind of unpack.
It is a strange scene. I think he is daring death at that point. He maybe wants to die. He certainly appreciates getting injured, which is deeply strange. And there's that dynamic works throughout the film. Later, the reason that he's captured by the Turks is that he decides to just kind of waltz into a Turkish-occupied Arab village, and thinks, you know, he says to his comrades that he's invisible and he can never be caught. And then there's this extraordinary scene with José Ferrer.
Yeah.
In which, you know, Lawrence, who thinks he has sort of trained himself to withstand physical pain and punishment, is broken, and you can see his sort of dawning on him that he's not what he thought he was. So and of course, eventually, by the end of the film, he has done all these heroic things, and he has won these great victories against the Turks at the sacrifice, in a way, of his decency, he all with the aim of giving the Arabs, as it were, their own country, and he's screwed over by the British diplomat, British and French diplomats, who negotiate the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which kind of divvies up divvies up that part of the world into Iraq and Syria and Jordan, which, and that's another thing that I think is really cool about the movie, which is that it's about Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about Baghdad, but it's about Iraq and Syria and how the Western powers completely fucked up this part of the world by double dealing and exerting their power geographically.
Yeah, I did a big history deep dive after watching that cleared up a lot of things. And it was interesting with the complexity of character like you. He almost never gets what he wants because on one hand, you get the feeling that what he wants most would be to be like king of a Middle Eastern country.
Mm-hmm.
But he also kind of wanted to be regarded as an English war hero. And to the point where he has this journalist following him around, photographer based on a real guy. And you can tell he's eating it up and he wants the press. But there was speculation, I think still today, that he was not as important as he made himself out to be.
I think that's right. I mean, I think somebody in the movie says it's a sideshow of a sideshow. That the war in the desert wasn't as crucial to kind of winning the war as the outsized heroics and sort of dash of the campaign seemed to let on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a deeply cynical telling of this story.
Yeah, you can see at the end too when he's that last scene where he's being driven away in the car and he passes the guys on the camels and you can see in his face he wants nothing more than to be on a camel again.
Right. Yeah, he's completely lost. Lawrence's later life, he actually tried to sign up to serve as an enlisted man. I think it was in the RAF, actually. I'm not 100% sure of that. But he wanted to have another run at it, but not as the celebrated war hero. So there's something, I mean, I guess admirable, but also deeply sad about that. And of course, the movie opens with his death, which of course has now become an old chestnut. In terms of biopics, but is pretty interesting in terms of how, you know, we see this character riding on a motorcycle and having a somewhat ridiculous accident due to his own foolhardiness.
Mm-hmm.
We never see him on a motorcycle again or see him in England again. So the sort of been told in this interesting reverse order, which is to say, no matter what he's going to achieve in the rest of the film, this is what is going to become of him.
Just some of the shots. I mean, now as a film viewer today, to see, you know, so many big battle scenes that.
Mm-hmm.
The more large and CGI they get, the less impressive they become, I feel like.
That's absolutely true.
And so
the more you can do.
It's amazing to see, like, the scene where they were unloading the horses off the train.
Mm-hmm.
Or just the scenes, those big wide shots of the camps or the guys going to battle on the camels and horses. I mean, to look at that and know those are all real things is just astounding.
Yeah, it is amazing, and I think that you can feel it as well. I think that the human mind is able to process the fact that these big CG battles are actually not taking place in physical space.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably reached its high watermark in terms of CG battle stuff in Lord of the Rings, and everything else is kind of aping that massive technology. But to see it in camera is pretty extraordinary. The scale of the operation, the fact that I think it was the Jordanian army was kind of enlisted in performing a lot of these battle sequences, that they were filming on location in the desert stuff that you wouldn't do nowadays, but that is incredibly effective. Because this was in the days, though, when you would shoot for months and months and months on end, and, you know, wait for the weather to be right and all kinds of stuff that we can't do nowadays, or we won't, or don't.
Yeah, I think one of my big takeaways, besides just the scope, was camels are amazing.
Camels are pretty wild.
They were a character in this movie.
There's a lot of camel stuff in this movie.
It's really good stuff.
Camels are amazing. Water is amazing. yeah.
Now, what was your introduction to Lawrence of Arabia? When was the first time you saw it? Do you remember?
Oh man, I feel like the first time I saw it was probably part of it as a kid. When it got mixed up in my mind with this much more schlocky movie called The Wind and the Lion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that
and,
movie.
My uncle produced a movie called March or Die. There was a sort of brief flourishing around the 1970s of Arabian or Foreign Legion war movies. And I must have at that time seen on TV some really crappy cut down version of Lawrence of Arabia, which still went on longer than I was allowed to stay up. And I didn't see it again until I was probably at like Film Forum or something. And then I remember very vividly seeing it at LACMA on the mm-hmm. big screen with Overture and intermission and everything, with my brother and my friend Matthew Huffman, and just being kind of bowled over. And then reading about the making of the film, Robert Bolt's screenplay, and just finding it not only kind of really beautiful, but incredibly intelligent.
Yeah, and then that score is just so iconic now.
Yeah.
Just amazing score that I believe the composer.
Maurice Jarre.
Yeah, he wasn't even the first choice. I think he was sort of third or fourth on the list.
That's interesting.
But and he didn't have a whole lot of time either, apparently. So he, and of course, you don't know if it's a chicken or the egg thing, but maybe it's because the movie was so iconic. But it really, man, when you hear that music at the beginning and you see that wide frame, it's just like chill inducing.
Absolutely. Yep.
So it won Best Picture, Director, Score, Cinematography, Art Direction, Editing, and Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And
sounds
lost,
right.
Yeah, Peter O'Toole lost to Gregory Peck for To Kill a Mockingbird. No shame there.
No, can't feel bad about that.
And Omar Sharif.
Although I think, I mean, honestly, I think Peter O'Toole's portrayal of Lawrence is more nuanced than Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird. I think that you're winning not just for the performance, but for the character.
Yeah.
In To Kill a Mockingbird, a sort of approving nod to the character.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Little one note. and then Omar Sharif lost, and then the screenplay did not win as well. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to
screenplay,
see it.
Wait, what won screenplay? God, screenplay should have won. That's
I think To Kill a Mockingbird did, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, so it must have been, did they have adapted screenplay and screenplay at that time, or was it only one category?
I think it was adapted, and this was considered adapted from T.E. Lawrence's.
From, right, Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Yeah.
Or some, yeah, okay. All right. All right. I think Lawrence of Arabia is a better screenplay.
I think I'm with you. And here's a couple of bits of trivia. I'm sure you know this stuff, but for the benefits of the listeners,
mm-hmm.
fairly interesting. Most of the movement in the film goes left to right,
right.
Very purposefully, because David Lean wanted to emphasize the journey aspect of it.
I agree entirely. I think that in the West we see things as going left to right, probably because of writing. I wonder if it had been made by an Arabic filmmaker, it would have gone right to left.
Oh, yeah. I noticed that O'Toole wrote right to left in one of those scenes, which I thought
right.
was a pretty
yeah,
subtle
little
thing.
He's writing Arabic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then for some of those great shots, David Lean's cinematographer, Freddie Young, apparently got a hold of a 482-millimeter lens.
Holy crap.
In order to successfully shoot a mirage. And
yes, okay, well, that would be when you first see Omar Sharif mm-hmm. arrive at the well, that amazing shot of him and his horse kind of appearing out of this mirage.
Yeah, for the benefits of non-filmmaking listeners, what does a 482-millimeter lens mean?
A 482-millimeter lens is radically outside of the bounds of what you normally use in making a feature film. You might go as, you know, you're usually working somewhere between 24 millimeters and 100, 100 being very tight, narrow frame for close-ups. 24 being something very wide, and 400 and whatever millimeter lens that is something like a specialty lens for maybe for industrial purposes or something.
Who knows?
and it means that the degree of compression between foreground and background is enormous. So you can shoot something very far away and it will appear to move forward very, very slowly. It'd kind of be flattened, and that's what you would use to, I guess, catch a mirage, but also something kind of hovering into view in a mirage. Like all of these lenses, especially when you get to the length, this is going to be being boring now, but of a 450-something millimeter lens, there are many, many elements to the lens. There are many, many lenses through that sort of tube of the lens, so that the light is doing all kinds of gnarly things. And they have to be very carefully calibrated in order to work properly.
I appreciate that insight. It was not boring at all. I think people appreciate that. All right. Well, we finish up with a couple of quick segments, one called What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
I like to go back and see what Mr. Ebert thought of these films. He gave Lawrence of Arabia 4 stars out of 4.
Fair enough.
And he had this to say, what a bold, mad act of genius it was to make Lawrence of Arabia, or even think that it could be made. The impulse to make this movie was based, above all, on imagination. The story of Lawrence is not founded on violent battle scenes or cheap melodrama, but on David Lean's ability to imagine what it would look like to see a speck appear on the horizon of the desert and slowly grow into a human being. It is a spare movie in clean, uncluttered lines, and there is never a moment when you're in doubt about the logistical details of the various campaigns. Lawrence of Arabia is not a simple biography or an adventure movie, although it contains both elements, but a movie that uses the desert as a stage for the flamboyance of a driven, quirky man.
That's about right. I mean, for quirky, I might say sort of unhinged, but yes.
Yeah, quirky was a weird word choice there. And then we finished
wacky,
with five.
Maybe?
He was wacky. Man, his eyes were just so blue.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even mention that Alec Guinness portrayed a Middle Easterner. Man. And
well, of course, now it would be beyond the pale to do that. But
sure.
if you're gonna whitewash, may as well get Alec Guinness to do it.
Yeah, he did a great job. Agreed. And then we finished with 5 questions with Chris Weitz. What's the first movie you remember seeing in a theater?
It was Midway, starring Charlton Heston. About the Battle of Midway, super schlocky movie, total gung-ho war film, which actually had a little spot of compassion for Nisei Americans, Japanese Americans. And I saw it in the Sag Harbor movie theater on Main Street in Sag Harbor, New York. It burned down last year and is just being rebuilt, which makes me very happy.
Oh, wow. All right. First R-rated movie you remember seeing?
Oh, man. Well, I don't... Was Alien R-rated?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's the one I can really first remember seeing. There's probably something in early HBO that I saw and shouldn't have seen. Seeing Alien, clutching my mom because I was terrified. I was still a kid at the time. It was a really bad decision to take me to that.
How old are you?
Ah, man. When did it come out? I was born in 69.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, I was not allowed to see it. I was born in 71, and my brother got to see it, and I didn't. It was sort of that thing where he was just old enough to see these things.
Right.
And I've told the story on the show before, but he came home that night and literally sat up for what felt like the length of the movie, telling me the whole movie, which is pretty great for a big brother to do.
That's good of him. That's nice.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
I will walk out of a bad movie made in bad faith. Right, I think that some movies are clearly crappy, and nobody is really gives a crap about it. But not a bad movie made in good faith, which is to say that it's hard to make even a bad movie. So I will hang in there out of a kind of a ritual obligation to the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, you get a trick or two even out of something that stinks.
Boy, that's a great answer.
Thanks.
A bad movie made in bad faith. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh.
It's like, you don't deserve for me to sit here.
Yeah, like, listen, if you didn't care about it, why should I?
All right, number four, we usually tailor to the guests, so I'm going to go with what movie and movie history do you most wish you would have directed? Or written.
Or written.
Or both.
Oh, man. I mean, it might be, I mean, it's another one of my favorites is High and Low, the Kurosawa film,
mm-hmm.
which I think is sheer brilliance. You know, a film that maintains tension, even though it's mostly shot in one room. Something like that. That would be fantastic.
All right. Good answer. And then finally, number five, movie going 101. What do you do at the movie theater? Where do you sit and what do you eat?
I usually don't eat anything. I know that's very sad, but I don't like crunching. I don't like being distracted by goobers, which if I did eat something, it'd be goobers.
Okay.
And let me see. If it's a full crowd, I would rather be front row center. If not, I'll try to get the best angle on the screen, which would be about five rows back in the middle.
Front row, huh?
Yeah, sometimes I like to be totally immersed in it. But actually, it really depends on the distance between the front row and the screen as well.
Right, sure.
Because I don't want to look around too much.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
This is a lot of fun.
That was fun.
Really loved Operation Finale, and congratulations on that. That's
awesome.
Quite an achievement.
Thank you, and thank you to your listeners for listening to me.
All right. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. How did we do? Did we cover the movie enough for you? I hope so. Lawrence of Arabia, there was a lot there, and he had really good insight on it. It was cool to talk to a director who was able to explain things like what a long lens means to someone like myself, and maybe to you. So I hope you learned something there, and really enjoyed his take on the characters and just the shooting of this film, which was just amazing all these years later to see a movie like this with those huge frames and all those extras and soldiers and horses and camels, and it's all real, everyone. It's not like it is today. So pretty amazing that they could pull a movie like this off. I believe Steven Spielberg has described Lawrence of Arabia as a miracle of a film, and I couldn't agree more. So big thanks to Chris. He was a really nice dude. It was great to talk to him, and maybe we'll meet in person one day. Support his work. Go check out Operation Finale in theaters August 29th. Very good, beautifully shot, taut thriller of a film. Highly recommended. And Oscar Isaac and Ben Kingsley, it doesn't get any better than that, everybody. So go check it out and support his future work. And thanks for tuning in, everyone. And until next time, why don't you go bring a Nazi to justice? Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.